I was reading a follow-on article to the reports of pedophilia-focused sexual abuse in Pakistan, where little boys were forced to perform sexual acts. They were filmed, and then they and their families were blackmailed. So it's a, you know, the combination of extortion, kidnap, enslavement, pedophilia, rape, sodomy, all of these kinds of things. I mean, it's your laundry list of disgusting decadence. And when the parents would find out about this, and they would take the evidence of the videos, being absolute proof that this occurred, with the perpetrators in the videos, to the police in Pakistan, which are part of the Islamic government. Land of the pure is what Pakistan means. You know what the police told them? Get lost. How'd you like to live in a country like that, Kirk?
We're not that far from it, but that's pretty... the trouble is the child will grow up to be, if he lives, he'll grow up to be a pedophile more than likely as well. And
yeah.
He'll have so much trauma, he won't function very well, I would suspect. And the father, if he loves his kid at all, would be thinking about murdering these people, which I think he should. But regardless, it's kind of like a circle that never ends. It just,
yeah. I'm not sure there's any collective conscious, that exists in the in a religious environment like that. You know, I'm not sure that the father has any clue what to do, and I'm not sure that the mother is going to raise another Muslim.
Yeah.
And
if you
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, if looking at the history of Pakistan, you know, it was a nation that was carved out of India in the mid '50s because of violence problems between Muslims and Hindus.
Oh, yeah.
You got to wonder what the West was thinking when they allowed them to become a nuclear weapons nation. You know, like, what did you expect when the violence was the cause for the formation of this nation in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, we have all this Sturm und Drang about Iran getting a bomb. Well, you know, when you talk about the Muslim bomb and stuff, well, Pakistan was one of the first, you know, Muslim nations to have.
And we actually went along with it because America wrongly was fixated on, because political correctness required Americans to be incorrect and to side with the Muslims and allow Pakistan to have a bomb to offset the Indian bomb. But the problem is that the violence between Pakistan and India, it wasn't mutual. No, the Muslims began to terrorize their fellow citizens, and they used terror tactics to get India to the point that says, listen, we don't want any part of you. You can go have your own country. The last thing we want is to be a part of you. And even when they got their own country, they weren't satisfied, and that's why the fighting exists in Kashmir. But
Kashmir.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is that
Kashmir has the Sikhs too. So you just like you have the Kurds in the other areas, you have this other Sikh population too, in the mix as well. And they're oppressed and everything. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. Most Americans don't know Pakistanis or something, but if you see Pakistanis portrayed in the media, you call them Pakis, and they're generally portrayed as easygoing, friendly types, like, you know,
New York. Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of Pakistani professionals in America, and, you know, on the surface, they seem like pretty likable fellas. Now, the problem, of course, is that this decadence in Pakistan runs very deep, and that there is no morality there. And you know, we are in a situation right now where we made a gargantuan mistake when we allowed Zygmunt Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter to deploy the Taliban, which is part of Pakistan, against the Soviets. And then, more stupid still, when we started sending Pakistan $3.5 billion worth of military equipment so that it can impose its dictatorial rule over its people and continue to be our alleged ally as they were arming and funding and controlling the very people we were fighting against.
Right. And, you know, it's a lot of Americans don't realize that, shortly after 9/11, there was nuclear saber rattling between Pakistan and India, but it kind of paled into the background because of 9/11.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, people don't realize how serious and severe that was, you know, and Americans, you know, State Department seems to be, you know, primarily concerned with just keeping detente between India and Pakistan.
But what gives a country the thought that you can go in and make things better by invading a country where the police tell parents that have absolute video evidence that their child was sexually molested, go away? How are you going to put a government in place in a country like that?
Yeah, that's very tough. And so who knows what role Pakistan will play in the midst of all this, you know, caliphate stuff and all that, you know, that sort of thing. You know, I'm assuming Pakistan is primarily Sunni, right?
Oh, it's exclusively Sunni. Well, not exclusively. It's about 95% Sunni, 5% Shia. And the Shias are really, I mean, the Sunnis in Pakistan are attacking very aggressively the Shias now. So it's a bad situation to be a Shia Muslim.
So the Pakistani Sunnis are antithetical to the Hindus, the Sikhs, and their own Shiite population. Not a pretty good picture.
That is correct.
Well, if that was Iran, I would want to bomb too.
I mean, of course.
I mean, surrounded by these guys.
Yeah, the principal reason that Iran wants a bomb has nothing to do with Israel. It has nothing to do with their hatred of the United States. It has all to do with the reality that they're extraordinarily vulnerable, surrounded as they are by Sunni Muslims who hate them, and that with a bomb it becomes impossible for Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and Turkey at all to invade them and attack them. That's why they want the bomb. That's why they're going to have the bomb. That's why it was willing. They were willing to sacrifice everything, including their economic prosperity, to get this bomb. And so that's where we find ourselves. If you want to talk about somebody that's against the world and yet has spewing out rhetoric that makes it sound like, we were just all buds, after just saying that the testimony of the disciples meant nothing to him, then Paul comes up with this line. And having known and having recognized the grace of the one having been given to me, Jacob and Kephesh, and also Yaukanan, presently presumed and regarded pillars, offered the right hand, giving it to me and Barnabas, fellowship as a result. We to the nations and ethnicities, and they to the circumcision. So, help me understand this. Help me understand this. You just said that the disciples had no credibility. Their testimony was completely worthless. So if the right hand of fellowship was indeed offered, why would the right hand of fellowship, why would an endorsement from people whose testimony was worthless be even worth writing about?
So why does a Christian have an Old Testament in their Bibles along with even the witness writings?
Right. But how could you be so schizophrenic? And how could you be a Christian and not say, wait a minute, he just said that the testimony of these individuals who were presumed to have a position of importance because of their past, the disciples, were meaningless to him. So tell me, why should their offering him the right hand of fellowship suddenly be meaningful? I mean, what Paul is trying to infer here is they all welcomed me into their group and said, yeah, you're one of us.
Yeah. No. Can't happen. Didn't happen.
Of course it couldn't happen. I mean, you'd have to be a nincompoop to put those two things together and not see the conflict. And then it goes on, you know, to name the three individuals. I mean, I kept on saying that the one that he's calling presumed the ones that presently regarded, the ones supposed to be leaders based upon some facts, some past, were specifically Jacob, Kephesh, you know, it's James, Kephesh, who is Peter, and Yahuchan and John. Remember I kept on saying that those are the three? Well, here he uses that same derogatory term, that those presumed and regarded to be pillars. Uses the same derogatory term, but he names the three.
Presumed.
So that means that from Paul's point of view, that the testimony of Yahuchanan, Shimon Kephesh, and Jacob are meaningless, which means you have to throw out the book of James, 1st and 2nd and Peter, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, the so-called Gospel of John, the book of Revelation, and the book of Mark, since it was written by Shimon's attaché. Goodbye. All of it gone. Wow. So he's demeaning not only the disciples, but the three most important disciples. And then he's pretending that because of some recognition of grace, which is a pagan goddess, that's the Ceres, that's the lascivious Greek goddesses of merriment, known to the Romans as the Gratia. And so they don't recognize him because of his affinity for the test, because, you know, he provided great insights that they concurred with regarding Yosha. Nope. They don't recognize him because of his acumen and understanding of the Torah and of Yosha's affinity for the Torah. Nope. They don't acknowledge him because of his the accuracy of his testimony. Nope. The credibility of his mission. Nope. Nope. They recognize him because of the affinity for these pagan goddesses.
Well, they were coexisters, apparently, according to him.
Oh, good grief. Good grief. I mean, if you read this and you can't recognize that Paul is not just a fraud, but a snake, there's something wrong with you. Yeah, they gave him the right hand of fellowship. And then it says that this right hand of fellowship was for them to have the circumcision and him to have the nations and ethnicities.
Explain to me why. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to ask, why did he get the endorsement?
Well, why would he want the endorsement of people whose testimony he didn't respect? And why is the testimony of Shimon Kephesh, Peter, at this meeting such that he said, no, what you're talking about in terms of limiting our testimony just to Jews is utterly ridiculous. Look at our history. Look at what Yosha asked us to do. What you're doing is wrong, and yet Paul is putting his sign on it, saying, no, the testimony of the disciples, the mission of the disciples, is limited exclusively to Jews. And since Christians don't have anything to do with Jews, why would they have anything about the disciples as part of their religion, including the first four books of their so-called Bible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially in light of, like, the Great Commission, right, at the end of Matthew.
Right.
Like, go into all the world, making disciples of all nations. Oops,
right.
Never mind. I'm going to have Paul do that. But actually, if I were a Christian pastor attempting to refute what you're saying about this,
yes,
I would make the suggestion that Paul was referring to two different groups. Like, they say that he, you know, the first he's referring to these spies crept in unawares, these, you know, people who were...
But you can't make the argument because of Dokia.
Let me finish. Okay. I'm going to say that he is going to I'm gonna say that he's like that these are, you know, troublemaking Judaizers, crept in unawares, who then ratted him out to the leadership. However, when he went up to Jerusalem and, you know, met with them, because he doesn't name anybody in the first, you know, allegation, set of allegations, and then later on he does specifically name, you know, Shimon Kafesh, Yaakov, and Yochanan. And so he does mention them. So he's apparently not afraid to mention their names, but he mentioned them supposedly as those who exonerate him in the long run after he endures these allegations.
Yeah. But you can't make that argument because I'm not in being informed, because while he does speak of the false brothers, who they would call as Judaizers, and of course you can't make that argument historically because there's never been such thing as a Judaizer, and that this group was extraordinarily tight-knit, and therefore there would never have been a false brother in this meeting. So he's 0 for 2. But Paul's attack isn't on the false brothers, other than they tried to take away their freedom. And, of course, that's the antithesis of the Torah. But beyond that, his attack is on those who dokei, who are supposed and assumed to be somebody important because of their past. And then he specifically denotes who the supposed pillars are, and that it's Shimon Kefesh, Yaakov, and Yochanan. And it's those supposed pillars, those people who were supposedly important because of their past, these three disciples, that he regarded as their testimony as worthless. So, you know, the words don't actually allow you to take that position. I mean, so the argument would only prevail in someone who isn't aware of what Paul actually wrote, what he said. And there's no wiggle room here. Not if you're informed. There is absolutely no wiggle room.
Well, except that he did, when he was condemning those who had some past, is it definitely clear that he's referring to, though, or is that inferred? That he, you know, that you're inferring that he's...
No, because he uses the same term, this supposed and presumed, because of their past, supposed and presumed pillars, uses exactly the same reference four times here. And all four times, it's to the same individuals.
And then he pans them, and then he claims their endorsement afterwards.
That is correct. Right. And he's also claiming that they're saying to him that they're going to be limited to the circumcision, which is wholly and completely opposed to what Yosheth told them. So Paul is imposing something on them that is the antithesis of what Yosha encouraged them to do. And so there is a 100% likelihood that either Paul lied or Yosha lied. One of the two is a liar. Both of them cannot be telling the truth. So which one do you suppose is lying, Christian? Okay, fellas, I got a quick question here for you. Were these guys, all four of these guys, John, Peter, and James, use their Christian names, and Paul, were they all Jews?
Yes.
Yeah. If they had the same message, if they were speaking for the same individual, what would be the purpose of dividing the turf?
Well, that's the question I wanted to ask, because if I know he's writing a letter to the Galatians, telling them that they've endorsed him, so you can follow me.
Mm-hmm.
So why would he need to do that, and why is he upset when Yochanan invades his territory?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yochanan obviously didn't agree, because where did Yochanan spend the rest of his life?
Right in his neighborhood.
Right in Ephesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where Yochanan spends the rest of his life. So how could Yochanan have agreed to this when we find Yochanan in Ephesus. And oh, by the way, where is the where is it alleged that historically that Peter met Mark so that Mark could write down what he had to say and Mark serve as his translator? Where was he?
That was in the same area, wasn't it, when he
Rome.
Went up there to see John?
Rome!
Oh, I'm sorry.
Rome! So you got one is the capital of Greece, the other is in the capital of Rome. And he's claiming that they agreed that they were going to divvy up the world this way. And you find one of them spends the rest of his life up there in Rome, and the other one is in Ephesus in Greece.
Greece, yeah.
But the bottom line is, were there two Yoshas, one for the circumcision and the other for the uncircumcision?
According to the church, apparently there was.
Were there two Yahwehs, one for the circumcision, one for the uncircumcision?
Well,
were there two covenants? Did Yahweh create a covenant for the uncircumcision?
No.
Were there two Torahs, one for the circumcision, the other for the uncircumcision?
No, I can't build that either.
No. So why, and you get right, of course, to the Great Commission. Why would Yahusha pick these 12 men and have them write these books if they weren't intended to be read by all men? Was Yosha's testimony only going to be interesting to Jews?
Hardly.
No. I mean, so this argument that Paul is making is so preposterous, so twisted, that it proves for certain is that the religion that grew out of his letters is filled with unthinking individuals.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, how can you lace it with pagan references and you couldn't take it anywhere except to the Roman world?
Yeah, and here he's also claiming that Barnabas was given this right hand of fellowship. What happened between Paul and Barnabas immediately after the Jerusalem summit?
They split up.
Right, and Paul condemns Barnabas. And in this very letter where Paul is saying that he got the endorsement of Kephas, Peter, doesn't he condemn him?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, right.
It's interesting when you just asked the question about a covenant. You know, is there another covenant?
Right.
It's interesting if you look at the quote Last Supper passages in Matanya and Luke.
Right.
The word in Matanya, you're just saying this is the blood of the covenant.
Correct.
In Matanya.
Right.
And in Luke, you have the word new in there. Is the new covenant.
Right.
But that's not in Matanya. It's in Luke.
Right. And it's also not in Mark, which is Shimon Kefesh's testimony. And so you've
right.
got two written by eyewitnesses, and it just says this is the covenant. And you've got
not
one
covenant.
that adds the word new. And
right.
it's Paul's bud.
Right. Right.
You know, and Christians will write me that all the time. They say there's no such thing as a renewed covenant. And why did he say it? And I said, have you ever compared? We have three accounts of what was taking place at Passover. And first of all,
right.
if you're going to take that line and call it an endorsement of your religion, then why in the hell don't you celebrate Passover? And if you don't celebrate Passover, you can't use that as a line. Because he was celebrating Passover. Now, and then
he was instituting the Eucharist, don't you know?
Oh, yes, of course. And then the next part of it is, okay, so you have three accounts of what was said. Two agree and one differs.
Right.
Why are you endorsing the one that differs? I mean, all you have for certain is a disagreement, a conflict between them, which says that one or both is not true. And you've got two that agree and one that disagrees. Why would you accept the one that is different than the eyewitness? Was Matanya there?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Why would you take Matanya's, why would you not accept Matanya's testimony, who was there, over Luke, who was not there.
Well, because scholars prefer Luke because his Greek is better. He has better Greek grammar.
Oh, of course he did. Well, first of all, Matignon didn't write in Greek.
Right.
He wrote in Hebrew. It's translated into Greek.
Right.
Right, and the primary language of Mark was Latin.
Right. And some of the worst, that's why some of the worst Greek in the New Testament is in Mark, then. You know?
Yeah. Translated again. There is, literally no hope for Christianity based upon Paul's testimony here. And, what I would also tell the Christian that wants to say, he talked about a new covenant and Luke. Well, okay, so all it does is prove that your New Testament was not inspired because it has internal conflicts. So that's the one thing that it demonstrates is that you can't trust it. But beyond that, why don't we look and why don't we see if there, since everything Yosha said came out of the Torah and prophets, why don't we see if there's a reference anywhere to a new covenant? And when you do that, what you're taken back to is to an improper translation of Kadosh in Jeremiah 31. But then if you're taken there and you don't read that in context, you end up with a conclusion that's the opposite of what's being stated. You're taken in context to the four passages surrounding Jeremiah 31 and the reaffirmation of the covenant. When you read that in context, it takes you directly to the passages that prove conclusively that there is no such thing as a renewed covenant.
Right. And this issue of questioning the plenary verbal inspiration of the New Testament is really, I've been discussing these issues with a friend.
Right.
And it really bollocks people up. They are terrified because they're terrified that if they relinquish this notion of the inspiration of the New Testament canon, that somehow they're going to lose, they're going to give up the whole shooting match. And it's like, they're going to have to give up Yosha. And I'm like, no, there never was. I mean, it's just amazing that this question of New Testament canon, like it is not an article of faith. It is not a requirement,
If you don't relinquish it, you have no hope in being truthful, no hope of being honest, because you've got the author of half of it that is a nincompoop, that is demon-possessed, that is insane, that is irrational, and that is wholly and completely deceitful. So if you don't get rid of half of it, now that destroys your canonicity. You have to get rid of half of it just to be rational.
Exactly.
And then you're left with the rest of it, and then you have to deal with the fact that there are more known discrepancies, changes, alterations of words in it between the oldest 69 manuscripts. There are more changes than there are words. 300,000 alterations in a document of approximately 180,000 words. Now, you have to be completely and wholly ignorant of the evidence to hold this notion that this is inspired and godly.
Well, and this is routinely kept from the sheep. I mean, even in the old Testament, like if you're the Torah and the Tanakh, not the Talmud, the other books. Look, this ridiculous notion of plenary verbal inspiration, it would be applicable only to the Torah itself. Not even, even Jews don't contend for, they certainly contend for the Torah, and they consider the prophets authoritative, but you don't see this emphasis on plenary verbal inspiration in of the prophets, merely that they are inspired if their message is true. But this idea of, it's really only the Torah, where you see people looking at things like the equidistant letter sequences and Torah codes and stuff like that, and the carefulness of the copying and the Jews are very, it just seems to me that this plenary verbal inspiration thing is preposterous.
There is, I think, ample evidence that, particularly when Yahweh was speaking in first person throughout his prophets, ample evidence throughout the Psalms, particularly those described by David, that they are word for word as Yahweh inspired them or spoke them.
Right.
And to the greatest degree that a human copyist attempting to make an exact copy, one from the another, was able to do, particularly as they're maintained in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are the oldest copies of these. The prophetic evidence, the accuracy of the history, the consistency, the brilliance of that story is such that any informed, rational person can make a case that that is divinely inspired, word for word, from Yahweh. But in the Torah, absolutely, unquestionably.
Absolutely.
And,
yes.
Yeah. And so now you're comparing that to this gobbledygook. This absolute cesspool of religious editing, a cesspool of contradictions that is the Christian New Testament, and apart from a very little of the testimony, Matanyah, Yahu Kanan, Revelation, apart from just a tiny amount of it, most of it's rubbish. There is no comparison. It's just astonishing. It's just as the Christian would cling to the line in Luke, out of context, apart from Passover, you have to do the same thing with the totality of the Christian New Testament. There's none of it that's credible. Paul's character is on display when he uses Dokiai in reference to Yaukanan, Jacob, and Shimon Kefesh. To Peter, James, and John. When he uses Dokia, he's saying they were supposed, they were presumed to be pillars. It's a completely derogatory term. There is a Greek word that Paul knows perfectly well, epikenozo, which speaks of, based on all of the evidence, as a statement, an absolute fact, with full knowledge and credibility, they are the pillars. They were disciples. Epigenosko. You could even in this sentence, he uses genosko regarding himself, which is to know. But no, he doesn't. There are three Greek words to know. Absolute knowledge based on the evidence. Thoughtful knowledge, and then being aware based upon your observations, even though they may be somewhat shallow. But then he goes all the way down below those three to pick up this word that is demeaning to them, and he uses it four times regarding the disciples. Yeah, it's slanderous. And you wonder what kind of a man would tear down individuals that Yahusha himself chose and lifted up. What kind of a man would do that sort of thing?
Well, we know that.
But yeah, you know, I recognized the flaw that was in Muhammad as I was writing Prophet of Doom. It's insecurity. That's why he craved and was never satiated with sex. That's why he craved killing others. That's why he craved abusing his and threatening those who criticized him. It's insecurity. Constantly cutting others down to lift himself up. But you know, when I was writing Questioning Paul, that same trait became obvious. The reason Paul's got such an ego is to hide, to mask his insecurity. That's why he's tearing the disciples down. He thinks that if he tears them down, it will lift him up. Wow. That's the kind of man that Christians call St. Paul, the Apostle Paul.
Yeah, apparently you now have the new Genesis cybersex site advertising during your show. Have you not heard that commercial?
Yeah, I know. It's I try to tune it out the best that I can, because the commercials are mostly so reprehensible.
What are you gonna do?
I'm And I'm sorry. I mean, I'm paid nothing by them. I have no association with them. I disavow them. Right. I've spoken against them.
They want me to get myself a drink and turn down the lights and log on with them, you know.
Right. And then
it's pretty transparent stuff. Yeah, you know. But anyway.
Yeah. I'm
trying to save me from carcinogens.
So I don't think there's anything that was more revealing of who Paul was than in his repetitive use of dokiai to speak of the disciples, particularly the most important three. You know, if you pick the sons of thunder, you know, John and Peter, by far the two most important disciples. And then Jacob, whether he was part of the fishermen or the Jacob that was his brother, regardless of which Jacob you pick, those are the most important three. And to claim that you represent Yahusha and to consistently demean the three most important individuals in his life, the three people that he entrusted his life work to, that message is so reprehensible that the notion that the world's largest religion grew out of this man's poisonous pen from his perverted soul, he speaks to just how stupid most people are, how ignorant, how irrational, how easy they are to fool. You've been fooled by Christianity. It's your own damn fault. The fact it's a lie is obvious. Now that you know, what are you going to do about it?